Hi, welcome. Welcome back.
Episode two of the Hell Money Podcast.
Hell Money Podcast. We're now in Casey's. We've changed our set.
That's right. Basically. We're in my apartment. Welcome.
Last week
we've hidden the kitchen behind this whiteboard.
Yeah. I don't even think you can tell that it's like gross and scuffed up. That was what we were worried about. Is it going to look gross on camera or normal? But I think it looks fine.
I cleaned the whiteboard.
Yeah.
Before I started.
Yeah. Last week we were in my gamer girl lair. Mm-hmm. This week we're in your bachelor pad.
That's right.
I think that's appropriate.
Yeah. The two vibes, right? The two genders, you know, of the podcast.
So that's why I dressed a little bit more like Hell Money Podcast, I think, today. Mm-hmm. Don't you agree?
Don't know what that means. What is the Hell Money Podcast look?
Well, I feel like it was a little bit, like Hell Money has this kind of hardcore thing to it. And last week we were like in my office with like my sewing supplies and like my crystal singing bowl.
Yeah,
like,
we're much more professional this week. We're like broadcasters, you know, at this table, which like is very, the table's very Joe Rogan, I feel.
I want to, actually my dream setup would be to like do like Alex Jones InfoWars style and just have like an infinite number of papers that I'm scrambling through the whole time. Each episode would start with like me going on like a deranged bit for like the multi-cam setup, you know? Yeah, that's hopefully where we're headed.
Yeah, absolutely.
What I'm saying.
Yeah.
But yeah, so this week, talking about...
Inflation.
I feel like that's really like the big topic that a lot of people are talking about right now, both in terms of just like economics and then like how Bitcoin fits into things.
Right.
And obviously last week we talked about the white paper, which mostly concerned with like privacy and the actual structure of the network, but didn't really talk about inflation, as we mentioned.
Exactly, right. The white paper completely leaves off... you know, the money supply of Bitcoin, how money is created in Bitcoin, who receives it, how that supply of money changes over time.
Right.
And obviously that relates to inflation.
Yeah.
As our favorite economist, Milton Friedman, once said, inflation is always and everywhere a monetary phenomenon.
See, I said this is like, originally I was like, okay.
She was talking shit about Milton Friedman. She was talking mad shit about Milton Friedman. I was deeply offended.
I still would. But I feel like this is the right-wing, left-wing perspective that
I hate being right-wing. I'm not right-wing.
I can see your coffee table books from here, and they're all like, just like, red flag.
They're really not right-wing. I mean, like, look, I got some George Orwell talking about being an anarchist in Spain. That's all right?
Like,
this is the leftist of the left-wing.
Yeah. You're right. Sorry, I'm being a little too... I'm reducing you too much to...
I know, like, the...
ineffective polarity.
The dichotomy is good, right? I wish there was a label that I didn't just bristle at, right? Like, I'm not right-wing.
Anarcho-capus. That's what you don't...
Yeah, anarcho-capus. Yeah, that's exactly it, yeah.
But yeah, so we've been talking... I mean, I feel like really what we want to do is we kind of want to go through, like, the history of, like, the U.S. monetary system, kind of just, like, what the modern economic situation is in the U.S., how it's played out in a variety of bad ways and why Bitcoin could potentially rectify a lot of those issues, right?
That's right, yep.
So yeah, I don't know. We'll see kind of, it might be a little bit meandering, just sort of going through our various thoughts. We have our notes here.
Yep. You can see mine. There, part of it is printed and the part of it is scrawled like a small child wrote it.
Yeah. So, I mean, really, actually, okay. So when I was writing up notes for this episode, because I was trying to sort of like organize my thoughts, I feel like I have a lot of like different little tangents that I go on with people about it, like inflation specifically.
Mm-hmm.
But when I was kind of organizing my notes, I was looking through. So I like to just like write notes in general, like when I think about things or like when I watch something thought provoking or read something, whatever. I try to like write up my thoughts because I like to be able to like reference back and be like, oh, like look
do
what I thought.
A little archaeology.
Yeah, a little self archaeology. And yeah, I found like notes that I wrote in February 2021, so like a little over a year ago, where I had just watched Adam Curtis's Can't Get You Out of My Head series, one of the episodes, which I don't know, are you familiar with Adam Curtis? He's like this BBC documentary maker. He's great.
Were you going to say documentarian?
Documentarian, he is. He's a BBC documentarian. And one of the episodes of that series was they mentioned Nixon ending the gold standard in order to fund the Vietnam War, mm-hmm. and just kind of had like a little bit about that. And I like really was just like, that was like the first that I really had ever heard of that.
Yeah, yeah. A lot of people don't really think about what money is.
Yeah.
If you ask a lot of people, they sort of assume that it's backed by something. They're like, oh yeah, isn't there like gold in Fort Knox that backs all the money?
Some Nazi gold in a vault somewhere.
Yeah, yeah, yeah. But really money now is just this kind of collective, you know, okay, it's valuable because we agree that it's valuable.
Yeah.
There's not, our money is just paper. Just
yeah. I mean, honestly, I feel like most of the people I talk to are like, money's fake. Money's not real. And I'm like, that's true. Mm-hmm. Like money is not real right now, but it did used to be tied to like a reserve of gold.
Right, right, right. So when money is, when money is backed by gold or is gold, that's called specie money. I actually don't know if specie money is when it's like a gold coin, but yeah, so there's money that's like backed by gold, money that is gold or money that's backed by gold or another precious metal. And then there's the money we have today, which is fiat currency, which comes from the phrase fiat lux, which is Latin for let there be light. So fiat currency literally just means let there be currency.
Let there be currency.
Yeah. Like
said Nixon. Somebody just made it up.
Yeah.
So yeah, basically Nixon untethered the US dollar from gold during 1971 because they were running out of money. The government was in debt from spending on oil and the Vietnam War. And so Nixon basically said like, screw it, no more gold standard. Let's go.
Yeah, yeah, it's easy. Like, right? Like, I mean, if you have a gold standard, this limits your ability to print money, right? Because if you print, if you have $100 of gold and then you have $100 of money in the economy, and then you start to print more money, and all of a sudden there's $110 of gold in the economy, but it's convertible, right? And people can still take a dollar bill to the bank and trade it for a dollar worth of gold. Mm-hmm. People will start to realize like, oh, I think that this money is actually worth significantly less than the amount of gold I can exchange it for. And so they'll start going and getting the gold. They'll be like, this, there's too much money for not enough gold. And if you're a government, this is like really inconvenient because you can't fund the politically expeditious things that you wish to fund. So then you're like, fuck it. Fiat lux. Fiat currency.
Yeah, yeah. Yeah, and I mean, when I was like learning about this at the time, I was really hung up on it because at the time I was super into Bernie, and a lot of like the kind of like Bernie adjacent economic theorists are really into MMT, modern monetary theory.
Yep.
Named such as a direct response to Milton Friedman's monetary theory.
My boy, Milton Friedman.
Yes. So dunking on Milton Friedman. But yeah, I didn't know much about MMT at the time, but obviously I'd heard of it.
Yeah.
And I kind of was like, how is what Nixon did different than MMT? Like, I was like, I don't know. Maybe it was just like a very basic realization to have, but it was the first time that I ever thought like, wait, we can't just like print money.
Right.
We can't just print money.
Yeah.
But I guess, I mean, we have basically for the last like 50 years, we've just been printing money.
Yeah.
And that's, you know, there's this like website called like WTF happened in 1971.
Right.
There's all these like various charts that some Bitcoin maxi put together.
Yeah, that about, all the charts like are like going good up until 1971, and then they go bad. Whether that's up
it's
or
like
down
always
or
like it'll be. Wait, now we actually have a whiteboard.
We have like the thing that's going, and then it goes like this, and this is like good, and this is like bad.
Yeah, and then it'll be
and
like
this is like 1971.
It'll be like this. And that'll be like top 1%, and that'll be like everyone else.
Right, yeah.
So it'll be like top 1% gets everything.
Yeah.
Everyone else gets nothing.
Yeah, yeah. And the implication is that it has to do with the money. Like that cites winking at the idea that all this is caused by getting off the gold standard.
Yeah, and I think they definitely like, I mean, there's like 100 plots on that website or something. I think once you really scroll down, it starts to become a little bit like, all right, man, like, you know, whatever, a little too galaxy brain.
And I wish I like riding in on my monocausal hobby horse, like more than anybody. I don't know if it's all due to getting off the money, getting off the gold standard.
No, but I think, I think it makes sense that like, you know, this kind of was the beginning of this like runaway fake propping up the system style of capitalism, neoliberalism,
It's not capitalism.
Sorry.
It's a crony capitalism. Yes. It's like, it's the bad capitalism.
We need to like create a new vocabulary or something.
Yeah, I want
to be able to refer to things, but everything just means different things to everyone.
Yeah.
So it's like,
like
in my notes, because again, this was like where I was in my brain at the time. I was like, oh my God, this was the start of neoliberalism. so offended by that word.
Yeah. No, it's hard. I mean, because like some people use capitalism where it's definitionally good. And some people use capitalism with a definition where it's like definitionally bad. And then it just depends on like what your definition is.
Right. And like I was using the word neoliberalism, which I feel like nobody, people identify as a capitalist, but no one would ever identify as a neoliberal. No. But like, what's the difference? Is like, it's just such whatever. Yeah. So words mean nothing. It's fine. Money means nothing too. So it's all good. But yeah, I mean, I think like, even though, you know, the sort of charts that just basically sum this up and point out like, here's 1971. Sure. A lot of them, like there's a lot of different things that have happened since 1971. Mm-hmm. I do think like it's pretty straightforward how like the government printing money and like, let's get this straight. They're not printing money to like give to the American people.
Right.
They're printing money to do things like buy out their own debt so that they can continue wars, so they continue spending on oil, so they can prop up the stock market, whatever. Right.
Just to accomplish their like short-term political goals.
Exactly. Right?
To stay in power, to smooth over problems, to, you know, in the short term.
Right. And like, I mean, you can see how that would result in the top 1% getting richer, the rich getting richer, and wages not keeping up, everyone else not being able to buy things because they're not getting that influx of
money. It's, they're not just printing money and handing it to people. It's always going in some way or another to insiders.
Right.
Right.
Right. So yeah, this was, it was just like funny finding these notes for myself because I was like, oh, like, look at me go. It's pretty dreadful.
It's like awakening.
Yeah. But yeah, I mean, you know, obviously that was 1971. Mm-hmm. Obviously since 1971, we've seen like much higher inflation rates, much higher like increase in the value of assets compared to wages, all these kind of things. Mm-hmm. But particularly since like May 2020-ish, we've seen like a huge spike.
Right.
And this was because lots of people kind of debate this statistic. It's a little bit misleading in some ways, but essentially 40% of all US dollars were printed, created, whatever, since May 2020.
Right.
So like 40% of all money that's ever existed and been minted, printed, whatever by the Federal Reserve has been created since May 2020.
Right.
And I think a lot of people, because I've been kind of in preparation for this episode and also just sort of organizing my thoughts about inflation, I've been talking to a lot of people about like, why do you think there's inflation right now? Because like, I mean, okay, so May 2020, all this money was printed. A year later, the Fed admitted to inflation rates of 5%. Now they've admitted to 8.5% with no sign of slowing down.
Right.
People are kind of aware of this now, right? Yep. That this is a thing. Yep. It's happening. Maybe they don't feel it directly, although most people buy gas. Most people feel that at least directly.
Mm-hmm.
And I've just been kind of asking people, like, why do you think this happened? Like, what do you think caused this? And a lot of people, what they say is COVID ended and people are getting out of the house, so they're spending more. Or stimulus checks sent to individual people.
Mm-hmm.
And it's so interesting to me that, I don't know, people think that economics are so individualized and like on like the ground level like that, when in reality, like most of this money did not go to stimulus checks for individual people. It went to buying government bonds, propping up the stock market, like basically keeping the economy afloat.
Right.
And like anyone who has invested in the stock market or owned a house or any sort of asset like that since 2020 has seen that money, right? But everyone else hasn't really. Mm-hmm. So like, you know, the home market price or the home housing market nationwide has gone up like something like 18 or 19%.
Mm-hmm.
And so like, that's really where you're seeing like the true inflation, inflation.
There's also
right?
apparently some trickery in how inflation, how rising home prices factor into inflation. Like it doesn't go
it doesn't completely.
It's sort of based on these surveys that don't really mean a whole lot. Like they don't actually include rising house prices.
Right. So like the inflation, the official inflation numbers are based on like the CPI consumer price index, whatever, which is basically this basket of things that they decide, you know, an average American should have.
Right.
So like food, gas, all these things.
Yeah.
But they don't include owning a home.
Right.
For example, they don't include saving for retirement. Yeah. All these kind of things that allow you to have economic independence and economic freedom are not considered a part of the essential American experience in the consumer price index.
Yeah. And one thing to remember is that inflation, like people sort of hear that there's like an inflation number that it's like 8% or whatever. There is no well-defined like single inflation number.
Right.
It's just like this one particular way of measuring it comes up with this one number, but it's different in different markets, right? Or for different goods, right? Mm-hmm. Some things are going to inflate slower. Some things are going to inflate faster. Some things aren't going to be captured. Like I'm almost like a inflation number skeptic. Like, can you really measure this thing in like any sort of reasonable way?
Mm-hmm.
Especially because like, for example, productivity increases will mask inflation.
Right.
Like, let's say that like prices double, right? But we get like, we get twice as good as making like microchips, but in the same period of time, price inflation doubles, right? You'll see the price of microchips just be flat because we're producing twice as many for half the price, right? So the sort of price, the cost to produce them is going down, but at the same time that there's inflation, right? So I'm actually like, sort of, I think that maybe there's a lot more inflation than people see because it's being, because there's productivity increases, right? Mm-hmm. That are being masked by, that are masking some of the inflation.
Sure. Yeah. Yeah. I mean, I think like an admitted number of 8.5% is honestly surprising to me that they would even admit to that because I think there is a lot of effort to kind of like mask the situation and like, I mean, not to get conspiratorial or whatever, but it's like,
no, let's fucking go.
Let's go. The fact that it doesn't include like buying a house, which is like, I mean, you want to talk about like a quintessential American experience. Like most Americans want to own their home or they want to own some sort of asset. That's like the easiest way of securing some sort of generational wealth, some ability to retire at the age of 65, all these kind of things is like owning a home, owning stocks, whatever, for better or for worse. That's the way that it is. And to not include those things in this inflation rate, I think it like intentionally or not, it masks the situation. And so while like, you know, maybe it is sort of impossible to put a definite number on it, like 8.5% is, I think, way under like what an actual like lived experience of inflation is in this country right now.
And nobody can contradict your lived experience.
Not mine. Not my lived experience, baby.
Yeah. I have no idea. I have no like guess about whether it's too high or too low. I'm just like very just like paranoid. Like I'm like, it's probably wrong in some direction.
Whenever I first paid $5 for gas, I like took a selfie, like I took a picture and I was like, remember this moment. This is saying I like to document my red pilling.
Right. Yeah, yeah. 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 Yeah.
But yeah, I mean, it's like, I think it makes sense. Like, I don't know. This is why it's so surprising to me when I talk to people and ask them, why do you think inflation is happening? That their answers are these sort of like small consumer moves that happen.
Right,
because to me, it's obvious that like, okay, you increase all this money into the money supply, you concentrate it at the top, trickle down economics, baby. Eventually, like that inflation rate of assets is going to trickle down to everything else.
I mean, ultimately, what is inflation? On one hand, you have like all the goods and services that are being produced in the economy. And then on the other hand, you have all the money, which is out there bidding on those goods and services, right? So if you double the amount of money that is available to bid on goods and services, you'd expect that the price of goods and services to double, right? More money chasing the same amount of goods, right? And so the rate at which the amount of goods being produced in the economy changes less rapidly than the rate at which the money supply can change, right? It's, you can instantly double the money supply, but doubling the amount of production happens much slower. So most of the time you should be looking at a monetary cause for inflation.
Right, right. And I mean, like, yeah, I don't know. I think like this isn't the first time that this has happened. Like obviously 2020, 2021, like the massive sort of money printing, we're finally kind of like a year later or whatever, really feeling the effects of it. But it's not like the first time that the government has just like printed money to bail itself out. Like this is kind of 2008 all over again. I mean, we talked about 2008 last episode is sort of like the origin of Bitcoin and like, you know, Satoshi kind of implying like they can't be trusted to handle our money. And I think like 2020, 2021 was just like an even more exaggerated version of that.
Right.
And I feel like they've kind of just delayed this economic crisis that is now only starting to ramp up now.
I mean, it's so tempting to kick the can down the road.
Yeah. Especially if you're a politician.
Yeah. Yeah.
I mean, we talk a lot like about, you love incentives, right?
Incentives. Incentives
are everything. Yeah. And like for politicians, the incentive is to like keep things good so that you can be reelected.
Yep.
And
that's another 4 years. Don't rock the boat, you know?
Yeah.
Yeah.
So there's no incentive to like address things head on. Right. Like, I mean, with the economic crisis as it happens.
If the way to fix something is an unpleasant period of like restructuring and like belt tightening and like non-productive businesses going out of business, like no politician is going to have the stomach for that.
Right.
Right. Like that's going to make them look bad. Everybody's going to blame them. And then, you know, if you have to go through an unpleasant period that then, you know, a couple years down the road, things start looking really good. That's like the opposite of what a politician wants. They're going to get voted out of office.
Yeah.
Somebody's going to replace them and then take credit for the, you know, economic recovery.
Yeah. Yeah. And I think that's ultimately like the strongest argument for like why value and money should be like divorce, you know, separation of money and state, whatever, the separation of church and state. I don't think that there's a good enough incentive system for politicians mm-hmm. to use printing money for people.
Yeah.
Because in theory they could, right? In theory you could print money and... so this is the Milton Friedman. MMT. But, I mean, let's say you can. I think there's like a decent... Like when I try to talk to like people on the left about Bitcoin, mm-hmm. I do think that kind of like the ideological difference or just the sort of like structural difference that if they feel this way, they feel this way. There's nothing really I can argue them on mm-hmm. is that in theory, it's not terrible for a government to be able to print money to fund certain services for its people.
Sure. Hypothetically, if the government, if government were competent,
right.
Which is a giant if, right. Yeah, if the government was competent and it could like allocate money well in an intelligent way, then yeah, it'd be great.
Exactly. So, yeah. But of course, the incentive structure of politicians is not really ever to do that.
No, like, not really. And also, I think it's also just like the world is complicated. What people do is complicated. The right decision is complicated. Mm-hmm. And so you're far less likely to make the right decision on your like top down sort of, you know, decision making, you know, then as a top-down decision maker, as a politician, right? Mm-hmm. A lot of good decisions come from a bunch of people with different information interacting and doing and their independent activities, right? That's mm-hmm. how like almost everything in the economy gets made. That's how like most good decisions gets made. It's just hard to make decisions in a top-down way, to look at the world and say like, okay, how should things be produced, right? Mm-hmm. It's why the USSR was such a disaster, right? You mm-hmm. have like a bunch of bureaucrats sitting there like planning the economy. They're just going to do it wrong because it's too complicated to centrally plan.
Yeah, right. Exactly. And like, I don't know. I think, yeah, bottom line, like, do you trust the government to control the money? No, we know Casey doesn't. I mean, I don't either. And I think it's that I think it should just be out of anyone's hands to decide like when money gets printed, when money gets distributed, because it has such a strong effect, not only in the US, but on the rest of the world, you know?
And it's so corrupting, mm-hmm. you know? I mean, like, if you are the person or the group of people that have the power to increase or decrease the money supply, you know, even if you have the best of intentions, in the back of your mind, you're going to be thinking, okay, like, you know, maybe this is, you know, this is not, you're always going to be thinking like, okay, well, how does this affect me? Right. Does this put me in power? Does this help my friends? Does this do X, Y, Z? Right. You're never going to get away from that incentive to just do it wrong.
It's like a Sims cheat code. Like mm-hmm. once you just start, you know, mother loading, giving yourself simoleons. Money, then the only thing that really gives you that hit is to like delete all the ladders on the swimming pool and let all your Sims drown.
That's right. Know? Yeah. So if you see politicians building a bunch of free pools, right, with ladders.
There's no such thing as a free pool.
No.
Yeah, so I don't know. I mean, do you have other...
I just want to talk shit about MMT. Like, I think MMT is maybe one of the dumbest things I've ever heard about, right?
Yeah.
What is MMT? MMT is the idea that the government can basically print infinite money, mm-hmm. right? As long as they also tax infinite money.
Yeah.
Right? The government can print $1 trillion as long as they also tax $1 trillion.
And it can't go bankrupt because who's it going bankrupt to itself? It's printing them, you know, it's just like sort of like loop.
Yeah.
Yeah.
But if the government prints $1 trillion and spends it on dumb shit that doesn't make us better off.
Mm-hmm.
And
which then, it does.
Which it does because the incentives are terrible. And then it taxes, was that $1 billion or $1 trillion? The same amount, mm-hmm. right? And it reduces actual productive, you know, activities, right? Because mm-hmm. taxes aren't free. It's not like people will do non-productive things to avoid taxes. You distort markets, etc. Right? Like the idea that the government can just like print money and then suck it out. And both the printing of money and the injecting of money and the sucking it out won't have terrible deleterious effects is just like insane, right?
Yeah, I mean, to me, like on a vibe / energetic level, I just mm-hmm. think like a top down approach to like if you think of money as like being like monetary energy, I mean, I don't know, what is money is sort of like a philosophical question in and of itself. And I think like a lot of people could argue money is nothing, it's fake, it's what we decide it to be because that's what it is currently. Yeah. I think like what money ideally is like energy that you can then like you know, taken or put out that allows you to do things and exchange value in the physical world.
Yeah.
And like, ideally you don't want that to be determined, or I don't want that to be determined from a top down structure.
I mean, from a vibes level, I'm with you. Right.
From a vibes level,
yeah. I mean, like, if you think about how energy flows through the universe, right. It flows like a river in all directions, from all places, all at once, meandering.
Yeah.
Highly mysterious, right. Chaotic and mysterious, right. It is not like some central being, you know, orchestrating everything.
No, it shouldn't be. I think like it, I think the ability to like exchange value with other human beings should be decentralized. It should be something that everyone has like, you know, a set standard on what this is worth, you know, ideally.
Right.
And also that everyone has like some way of accessing, which like, again, I feel like Americans are just not really like aware. They're not really aware of like how bad inflation can be and how like life-destroying inflation can
be.
And they're also not aware of what it means to not be able to access currency.
Yep.
And I think both of those things, it's like, yeah, you need to have like value that's agreed upon by everyone with your money. Yep. And you also need to have everyone be able to access it rather than the rich being able to both control the value of it and to distribute it amongst themselves.
And a couple important points that people don't think about. One is inflation is bad for people who have cash and good for people who have debt. Right. And the wealthier, richer people tend to have less cash because they have more assets and more debt. Right. They they borrow more because they have good credit. Right. Poor people, you know, we talk about them being in debt, but in general, poor people borrow less than rich people. Right. So the cost of inflation is borne by the poor more than by the wealthy. And then also wages are sticky, meaning that you have a certain wage that you like bargain for at your job. It doesn't tend to keep pace with inflation. It sort of will, you know, inflation will happen, making your wages less valuable over time. And then you'll get like a bump to bring it up to the current, you know, sort of value. So because wages lag inflation, that's another reason why the cost of inflation is borne by the poor.
Right, right. Yeah. And I think like, I mean, you touched on debt a little bit as well. Like, I think like having an economy that's fueled by like inflation incentivizes taking out more debt,
right?
Because like your debt is set at a certain time and then it becomes less and less like as things inflate, which in a perverse way, I think makes a good argument for people who have a lot of student loan debt to be pro-inflation,
Absolutely.
But I won't go down that rabbit hole. But I think like, yeah, again, on a vibes and energetic level, I don't think that it's great to have an economy that is mostly funded off of debt creation. Like, I just, what's it do to your karma as a society?
All the major religions like hate debt. They have like built-in like debt jubilees, like every 7 years all the debt is forgiven. They have laws against usury, against lending with interest, right? Like I think in Christianity it's entirely prohibited. In Judaism, a Jew can loan money to a non-Jew with interest, but they can't loan money to a Jew at interest.
Wow.
Yeah.
I didn't know all that.
That's why in medieval times, they would have a court Jew, because as a non-Christian, a Jew was allowed to lend money. It wasn't like a weird, like the Jews taken over or whatever. It was like the Christian religion, like prohibited lending at interest. So they would like get a non-Christian, which is very convenient. So they could like finance everything.
Wow, I never knew that. That's a pretty fun fact.
Yeah, usually.
How often do you get to like dull that one out? That like
very
really
rarely.
Had to be
very
quite
rarely.
Down a rabbit hole for you to be
really
able to
excited that we got there. Yeah.
Yeah, but I mean, it's just like, I don't know. I think ideally you have an economy that is like fair and everyone decides on it. And it's not based on this like idea that like you take out debt to get more money.
Mm-hmm.
And also like, because I mean, you're basically like enslaving yourself to the system in doing that, because you have to pay off that debt, like whether it's student loan debt or like a mortgage or whatever, like you're basically making it so that you have to continue to work or acquire capital in some way in order to like pay that off, rather than just sort of like living and buying things within your means, whatever.
It's also, you know, it's a bad incentive for the government, right? The government has a credit card. Individuals are often not good with credit cards. The government is terrible with credit cards.
Yeah.
It just can, it's so politically expedient to take out debt to fund the operation of the government, to kick the can down the road, which also then means that you're incentivized to inflate because you want to inflate down the real cost of repaying that debt.
Totally. And like, since everyone's like retirement accounts are basically wrapped up in the stock market, because like you can't have your money just sitting in a savings account if you don't want it to lose insane amounts of value.
Yeah.
What that means is it's very difficult to take on corporations, because if the corporation goes down, suddenly you get this whole demographic that's retiring in the next 5 years or is retired. And they're like, hey, why is my 401k suddenly complete? You know, when you have it that like everyone's individual wealth is tied to the stock market going up, like that's hell world.
Yeah. And also, and not in the good hell money podcast way, but like,
I haven't decided, is hell money Bitcoin or is hell money fiat?
I don't know.
I don't know.
I think hell money is fiat.
Yeah.
In that it's like an off, it's like an awful, terrible, burning hell.
Yeah.
Right. But then hell money is also Bitcoin in the like money of the underworld, like a more powerful sort of like, divine.
The karmic reckoning.
Yeah. Karmic reckoning kind of money. Yeah. So, but one thing is like, you shouldn't have to invest in the stock market. That's one consequence of inflation, right? If you don't have an expanding money supply, you can literally just take your money and put it, like under your like mattress, and increasing productivity will make your money worth more later, right? You shouldn't have to like, investing in the stock market is like a specialized activity. Like you should only have to, you should only do that if you're a specialist. The default for normal people shouldn't be that you're required to invest in the stock market.
Yeah.
And then also like, you know, you can only invest in the stock market if you have enough liquidity. Like if you're like a poor person, you have like less than $1,000 in savings, you can't afford to put that in the stock market because you can't afford that, for that money not to be in your checking account. Right. So again, that's a way that inflation hurts the poor.
Yeah.
Yeah. So
it's terrible.
Terrible.
We're very anti-inflation.
Very anti-inflation.
We're inflation-pilled on this podcast.
Yeah.
And evidently this only started a year ago for me. So like, wow, how far I've come, you know? So how does Bitcoin fix this?
Yeah.
Obviously we're a Bitcoin podcast.
That's right.
And we've kind of laid out, I think, you know, the historical context, the modern context as of like the last 2-3 years, the situation that we're in right now. Like, what is the reason why people point to Bitcoin as being like a potential remedy to this situation?
So in Bitcoin, the way that the Bitcoin network works is that every 10 minutes there is a block, and every block a new fixed amount of Bitcoin comes into existence.
We should have had your block clock or whatever.
Yeah, we should. Block clock next time.
Yeah, next time block clock for sure.
So every, like, according to the rules of the network, the rules of Bitcoin determine how much new Bitcoin comes into existence every block. That new Bitcoin is called the subsidy, and it is fixed. It was the supply schedule was fixed in 2009 when the Bitcoin Genesis block was mined, and it's basically impossible to change. There's an incredibly strong social and cultural and technical convention all built around these rules, especially this one, that makes it like sacrosanct and absolutely impossible to change. So
finite money supply.
Finite money supply, but I think even more importantly than that, a predictable money supply that nobody can manipulate.
Right.
So yeah, the Bitcoin money supply kind of looks like this over time. What does it look like? It looks like that, where it kind of starts growing quickly and then it levels off. And it levels off at 21 million Bitcoin. I think that's a little B there. So there will never be more than 21 million Bitcoin. And right now, as of this moment, there's about, I don't know where we are in this graph, but let's say we're like here, and there's about 19 million Bitcoin in existence. So we're actually pretty much done printing Bitcoin. There's only going to be like 10%. Ish more Bitcoin ever printed for the rest of the lifetime of the network.
And the last Bitcoin will be printed, whatever,
mined,
in 2140, right?
Something like that. Yeah. There's actually going to be for the 4 years leading up in so the first we started with 50 Bitcoin in the subsidy per block, and every 4 years that gets cut in half.
The halving.
Yeah. So there was the 50 Bitcoin per block reward epoch, and then there's the 25 Bitcoin per block reward epoch, and then the 12.5 Bitcoin per block reward epoch, and currently we're in the 6.25 Bitcoin per block. So every block, 6.25 new Bitcoin are being created.
Okay.
So the end, it's actually going to slow down to a very small amount, far in advance of it actually stopping. So there's going to be, like, for example, from like 21, 36 to 2140, every block is going to produce one Satoshi, which is 1/100 millionth of a Bitcoin.
Wow.
So it's like, it's absolutely nothing.
Word.
Yeah.
Huh. But, and then in theory though, like the value of Bitcoin goes up with that, right?
No. So, there's the miners, the incentive for miners to mine comes from two places. It comes from the subsidy, which is new Bitcoin that's being created per block, and transaction fees.
Right. Okay. So we're leveling off to the point where transaction fees would be the only thing.
Transaction fees must rise in order to keep the Bitcoin network secure.
I see.
Yeah. And also, this is something that like a lot of Bitcoin people are just like, oh, it's not a problem. It's going to be fine. I think it will be fine. I think it's okay that we need transaction fees to rise. But I think that it's something that we should be cognizant of because it needs to happen. And we can't just assume that it's going to happen. But
right.
We shouldn't worry. If transaction fees don't rise, there are lots of clever ways to deal with that.
Mm-hmm. And, you know, 2140 is a long way off. No, not to...
Well, probably...
but, you know, we kind of have like... what, like over 100 years at this point?
No, well, like the thing is that the block reward drops off so quickly.
That at some point it's sort of...
Yeah, I mean, like after another halving, it's going to be 3.25 or whatever. And then like 1.5 and then like 0.75, probably around the time that it gets to like 0.5 or like 0.1 Bitcoin, you know, we'll start to really be reliant on transaction fees. So I'd say that like it's a next like... I don't want to put like be definite about it or anything, but like it's the next like 20 years kind of problem.
Sure.
Like that the block reward will start to decline.
Okay. Yeah. So then I guess tying it back to inflation, since we're kind of talking about,
yeah.
I mean, I guess we can compare even like this is like the fiat monetary supply and then
right.
this is the Bitcoin monetary
right, yeah.
supply. And this is sort of this like existential or exponential up.
Mm-hmm.
And then this is just the
exponential flat.
Yeah.
Yeah.
Right. And so like, why is that favorable over, I mean, infinite money printing.
Right. I mean, it means that, it means that the, what a Bitcoin can buy, will tend to be stable.
Mm-hmm.
Right. So it means that, if you're getting paid one Bitcoin today, you can plan ahead. You can make planning decisions knowing that things are going to cost roughly the same amount.
And that's why it's like funny to me when people say like Bitcoin's so volatile. It's like, I'm like, well, you're looking at Bitcoin versus the US dollar, which
right.
is incredibly volatile right now. Not to say, obviously, I think like the market is shaking out and so many people view Bitcoin as this like speculative asset.
Right.
And so the volatility is also a feature of it.
It's also weird. Like Bitcoin is volatile, but in general goes up.
Right.
And the dollar is like not very volatile, but always goes down.
Right.
Right. So I'd rather have the volatile asset that usually goes up instead of the guaranteed losing asset that is not very volatile.
Yeah. Yeah. And I mean, I think like we're seeing sort of an acceleration of the dollar kind of losing value very rapidly
right.
in like the next like couple years or
yeah.
so.
Yeah.
And I think like, I don't know, I feel like we've yet to see Bitcoin diverge from just like the S&P 500. Like so far, like the market of Bitcoin kind of like matches the market of the stock market. And I
well,
think that
is sort of except it like 5x's every once
sure,
in a while.
Sure, sure, sure.
Right?
Yeah.
Yeah.
But same kind of, you know, I think like
in the lulls, it kind of matches the S&P.
Right. Ideally, at some point you'd have this diversion where like the US economy and the stock market is like kind of floundering because of the money printing and Bitcoin becomes the stable asset.
Yeah.
I think.
I mean, and to go back to your question, like what's the benefit of a stable money supply? I mean, really it's that, you know, there isn't a, you know, stream of new money being injected into the economy that's going to insiders, right? That is going to like things that don't really make people better off
right.
and which is inflating the currency. So it makes people worse off.
Mm-hmm.
It also means that the government has to make like, if governments can't print money, they have to make harder decisions about how they're going to spend money, right?
Mm-hmm.
They have to like be subject to the constraint that they have finite resources to spend. And I think ultimately that's going to force them to make better decisions.
Right? I agree. And I think, I mean, especially just looking at like war, for example, I think there's so much money that goes into war from the United States. And I think
right.
Americans generally don't feel the effects of war.
Right.
You know, war abroad is pretty much removed from our day-to-day lives.
Yeah.
But if you have like, you know, a hard money supply where the government can't just print money in order
right.
to fund its war,
right.
you are going to feel the effects of war.
Right.
And
right.
I do think
and
like,
governments are just going to be less willing to go to war.
Exactly. That's exactly like, I mean, you know, who knows, whatever. It's all like up in the air. There's lots of different factors. But I think in general, if the people pay more for going to war, especially in this country, people are going to be much less likely to support efforts of war.
Right.
Because right now it's sort of this like, oh, well, I don't want to be a bad person is kind of the main like reason. Like, right. People are like, I believe war is wrong. It's this like moral ethical question. And there's lots of people that are like, freedom abroad, whatever. It becomes this existential question.
It'd be great if it became like, oh yeah, we're going to have less healthcare if we go to war.
Exactly.
Do you want healthcare or do you want war in Iraq?
Like, exactly.
Your choice.
I think it's like, again, incentives. I feel like we'll bring up incentives like every episode of this podcast. But yeah, if you have the incentive to not go to war because it's going to cost you somewhere else, I think that just makes things, I don't know. I mean, I think the money supply should be tied to like people's real tangible lives. That's the point of money to me, is that like money is a way of like assigning something, whether it's Bitcoin, US dollar, gold, whatever, to a real tangible thing that we all agree on.
Yeah. I mean, money, I think, is a technology, right? Mm-hmm. It is a technology that has a purpose. Money and the price system are there as a mechanism for everybody to coordinate via the price system, right? What gets produced is when the price of something goes up, that's a signal that we should produce more of it or consume less of it. And when the price of something goes down, then consume more of it, produce less of it, etc. Mm-hmm. I think I got that backwards, but whatever. So like, I think that one, like all these things like printing money and taxes and etc., they all deflate the price system. They all interfere with the price system, mm-hmm. like the function of the price system, the coordination function of the price system. And I think we do that at our own peril.
Exactly.
Right?
Yeah. I mean, I think it's the kicking the can down the road kind of thing. Like, I think at some point we have to like, especially as like America, because we're, you know, that's what we do best, is kick the can down the road for our own gain.
Yeah.
Like, I think at some point we have to face up to like all these various things that we've sort of kicked down the road and like actually try to tie ourselves to some version of reality.
Right. Right.
I don't know. I think like that's something that people on the right, left, whatever, like should probably all agree on. I guess not the MMT people, maybe not Nixon funding the Vietnam War, the politicians, whatever. But like, I think the idea that like money should be tied to something tangible, whether that's Bitcoin or gold, I think there's a lot of good reasons why it should be Bitcoin and not gold, but that money at the very least should be tied to something.
Right.
Like, seems reasonable to me.
Yeah, totally.
And I guess going off of that, like, why is Bitcoin better than gold? Like, why should the US go to like a Bitcoin standard or Bitcoin world as opposed to like a gold standard world?
Yeah, a bunch of reasons. So one is that Bitcoin is actually a harder money.
Mm-hmm.
Nothing changes the issuance rate of Bitcoin. However, with gold, we think that there's a fixed supply. We think that there's like a fixed amount of gold. But all the gold in the world that's used is dug up out of the ground. And the rate at which we dig the gold up out of the ground actually changes.
Mm-hmm.
As the price of gold goes up, marginal gold mines are now profitable to operate, become profitable to operate again,
mm-hmm.
and more gold is dug out of the ground. So it means that the supply of Bitcoin is actually less influenceable than the supply of gold.
Yeah. And also like, I mean, if you just think about like the decentralization of that extractive process from Bitcoin to gold, it's like anyone can mine Bitcoin, but not everyone can like buy a gold mine.
Right.
You
know? And also mining Bitcoin is probably more environmentally friendly.
Yeah. Right. Despite the FUD. It's probably better to mine Bitcoin than it is to dig gold out of the ground in like the Congo or whatever.
Right. I mean, the cheapest energy in the world is renewable energy, is like hydro, solar, and wind. And so Bitcoin miners seek out those sources of energy,
right?
Which is much better than like digging giant holes in the ground and like mercury and like whatever else goes in the ground.
Trying to go to an asteroid and mine an asteroid or whatever.
Yep. And then also the other thing about gold is that it's just, Bitcoin is much, much better, right? Gold is physical. So, you know, if you're going to trade it, it involves an actual physical like exchange. You've got to move the gold from place to place.
Mm-hmm.
If you don't move the gold from place to place, it's got to sit in a vault somewhere. And then you get like gold certificates that you trade with people. That's subject to corruption. That's subject to centralization. There's been many times through history where, you know, governments have relied on a bunch of gold being in a particular vault.
Mm-hmm.
And then when they wanted to take it out, like, oh, there isn't the gold in the vault, or the person that's holding the gold in the vault says, oh, just kidding.
Right.
You can't get it out.
Also, gold is actually useful for certain things. Like, we want to be able to like use gold for certain like industrial reasons.
That's true.
Like,
yeah. If gold were cheap, then we would be able to use it for a lot of useful things.
Like making nice jewelry.
Nice jewelry, little connectors on USB
things.
grills for wrappers.
Mm-hmm. I actually do really want a gold tooth as like a doomsday prep.
Yeah, I actually do like the idea of gold tooth. Yeah. I think that a non-gold tooth is just kind of lame.
Yeah.
You know, like a porcelain tooth? Like, come on.
I know, that's what I... Well, not to be gross, but I have a baby tooth that like needs to come out, so I need to get a fake tooth. Uh-huh. Wait, I'll show it on air. Look.
Oh, nice.
It's so cute, isn't it? Baby tooth. But I have to get it out at some point, and I'm literally like, I need a gold tooth.
Definitely.
Because then, you know, what am I going to do whenever I have to barter at the last, you know, whatever. I got to yank it out.
Yeah, totally, yeah. The other thing about gold is that the transaction costs are very high, right? If it's very easy to take a gold coin or like some gold and take some other heavy metal like tungsten or something else and coat it in gold.
Right, so how do you know you have gold?
Right, exactly. You have to go through this very expensive assaying process where you like you get the value of gold. All this means that gold tends to be very centralized, right? Because of the costs of dealing in gold, it's much more convenient to put all the gold in a vault and have like, and everybody knows that the gold in the vault is good, like the London Gold Exchange or whatever, and then have certificates that people trade, you know, outside of the vault that like represent gold in the vault. Right. And that's inherently centralized, right?
Yeah. I also think like, you know, just Bitcoin is for the digital world. Like we are at this point where like you can exchange money with anybody anywhere who has access.
This is like a vibes-based argument.
It's a vibes-based
argument. Yeah. No, I'm into it. Yeah.
But it is, I mean, it's like, it doesn't really make sense to like if we're trying to be forward thinking about like what world do we want to see in the next like 50, 100 years.
Yeah.
To me, it doesn't make sense to like do this like backward looking, like, oh, things were better when things were tied to gold. It's like, no, we have this thing, this technology that seems like it's a lot better fit for the current economy, which is mostly done
digitally. Digital money.
Digital money.
Meme money. Yeah. Money of the people. Money of the internet.
Yeah. I'm pretty sure the people's money is Dogecoin.
The people's money. No, fuck Dogecoin. Dogecoin is a joke. Like, I was on the Dogecoin repo, like, looking at the development discussion, and they're basically, like, rehashing a discussion that Bitcoin had, like, 5 years ago. It's comedic.
Wow, surprising that they're even doing that, though.
Yeah, it's the level of discourse on Doge is it's not good.
It's not good. Cute, though.
Yeah. I mean, Doge. It's funny. I like the memes. I like the Doge memes.
It's much easier for me to convince people to buy Doge than Bitcoin, unfortunately.
Yeah. I got my, I orange-pilled my hairdresser.
Wow.
And paid her in Bitcoin. Yeah.
Oh my God. Yeah. Casey.
Lightning Network, wallet of Satoshi, payment went through immediately.
That's pretty
good.
Gave
her a nice tip. And then she, like later that day, she was texting me like, what about Cardano? Should I buy Cardano? And I was like, you are progressing very quickly. That is called a shitcoin. Do not buy Cardano.
Wow. That's pretty cool. Proud of you for that one.
Yeah. I like to really push it when I can. One thing I want to talk about is just really, really quickly.
We got time. It's fine.
Yeah, like inflation. If you live in America or Europe or Japan or, you know, some other country that has a well-managed currency, you are really shielded from the reality of inflation.
Totally. So, at least
like,
for now.
Yeah, like inflation, we have like, okay, 8% inflation, right? Mm. This is bad for us. This is the norm for most other countries on Earth. If you look at a map of like inflation rate by country, South America, Africa, most of Asia, Russia are like blood red. Mm-hmm. We talk about the irresponsibility of the American government in managing the money supply. Other countries are way, way, way worse.
Yeah.
And the people suffer deeply to the point where like I think it's like it's like almost like colonial imperialism to be anti-Bitcoin, right?
Yes,
because
yes,
like the
I
like
completely agree.
Not really understanding the real problems that other countries face when you people in other countries face when the currency inflates like 20% year over year, right?
Mm-hmm.
That means your money is just evaporating. And people in those countries don't have access to the US stock market. They don't have access to assets that they can use to preserve their wealth.
And it's on purpose too. And I think people don't realize like, you know, colonialism is still alive through like that sort of currency control.
I don't know if that's a good argument because like, you know, if you look at like, I mean, like the countries, most of the, you do still have countries that have legacy colonial currencies, like the West African franc and the other like African francs that are like tied to the French franc.
Mm-hmm.
But then if you look at other African countries that have their own currencies, those currencies are doing way, way worse. They're way worse managed. Like
sure.
It's bad. Like things like the West African franc are bad because it means that those countries don't have control over their own money supply. But they are good in the sense that the franc is, you know, not the franc. I mean, I guess it's tied to the euro now. The euro doesn't inflate like crazy. And in those countries that have done away with those like colonial monies, the inflation is way worse because those like those random currencies are just managed even worse than
the euro. I think it depends on who you ask. Like, I do think it's like sort of up in the air. I don't think it's a definite, like, I mean, that's essentially the reason why they chose to like adopt the Central African franc, for example, is like this idea of stability. Mm-hmm. But in the same, at the same time, they also like have made it so that like France gets to decide who purchases their resources and for what price, and France takes a cut.
Yeah, totally.
And like,
yeah.
I mean, I've definitely seen like various like economic studies that have sort of argued one way or the other. Like, I think it's
hard to argue that 30% inflation is like good or doesn't like just
sure. You know? But like, you know, these countries that are like under the franc also are some of the most mineral rich countries in the world, and they're not able to do, you know, free market whatever economics with those resources. Like, I know what you mean. Like, it's I'm not necessarily trying to say that like having their own independent currency they'd be doing just fine, but I think like the idea, it is a bit of like a sell, I think, this idea that like, oh, we're doing you guys a huge favor.
I wouldn't say that it's good. I mean, like, yeah, just that there's trade-offs, right?
Right, exactly. Yeah. I mean, yeah, and like the Central African Republic just announced that they're accepting Bitcoin as legal tender, so what a meme country.
Like, the Central African Republic sounds like a made-up country. Like, oh, we need an African country for a movie, but like, let's use a fake one. Like, let's go with the Central African Republic.
I mean, but now we're going to actually see, you know, the third option in power, right? Like, where, you know, before it was either you have your currency that inflates 30% a year or whatever, or you adopt the, you know, subset of the franc and are then under France's thumb for better or for worse. And now we kind of have this third option of adopting Bitcoin. And I mean, we'll see how it goes.
I think that it could be like amazing. I mean, in a lot of these countries, like, they don't have access to a decent currency that allows them to plan to, I mean, you know, like, you need some amount of stability in order to be able to like undertake enterprises, you know, to do investment, to do like, okay, I'm going to buy this thing and then I'm going to sell it tomorrow. I'm going to start this business. I'm going to do X. I'm going to do Y. So I hope that Bitcoin and like a stable asset that people can save and invest and spend will, you know, really help productivity, help planning, allow these sort of like places that historically were not super economically productive, you know, up their game.
Yeah. And I mean, just allowing individuals access to currency as opposed to like having to trust their government. As you said, you know, like, trusting our government, obviously Americans don't, a lot of Americans don't trust their government now, but comparing the American government to like many other countries where you do have this like insane inflation rate, whatever, like, we take for granted how much stability we do have. Right. And like, I think with Bitcoin, you know, it's sort of yet to be seen how things are going to pan out exactly. Like, I think people who have this like utopian idea of like, Bitcoin's going to come in and everything's going to be amazing, guys. Like, it's going to fix everything.
Yeah. Speaking of monocausal hobby horses.
It's like, I do think like, I mean, everything we've sort of laid out here, I think, shows that there's a better incentive structure to have money tied to something, to that hard money, to Bitcoin, whatever. Right. You know, but it doesn't mean that it's going to solve everything. But I think it is the way forward.
Helps a lot.
And we'll see what happens, man. Yeah. Is there anything else you wanted to talk about today?
No, I don't think so. I just had, I had government incompetence as like an item here, but I think we talked about that.
Yeah, I think we definitely covered government incompetence. Word. Okay. Well, yeah, I don't know what we're going to talk about next week.
No idea.
We'll see.
Yeah.
But yeah, until next time.
Let us know what you want us to talk about.
Yeah. Yeah, but I guess signing off. Thanks for watching.
See you next time.
Bye.